You are listening to Prometheus by Minute. I'm your host, Connor Coulson. This is Minute 69. This minute opens with David surveying the ampules and ends with the rest of the crew continuing their search for Milburn and Fifield. And for the next few episodes, I'll be joined by Niall of Bat Minute 89, which just wrapped up Batman Returns.
Yeah, hey Connor, thanks for having me on. I was so fighting the impulse to go, 69, dudes!
I know
that. To do in every episode of any show that I'm on that happens to be on episode 69.
Nice. I don't know what we should do to celebrate episode 69. I mean, Prometheus is already so emphatically sexual that... how do we go up from there? We're already at 10. How do we get to 11?
Well, maybe we'll figure it out.
Shout out to Spinal Tap.
Maybe we'll discover it as we go along. You never know what kind of crazy chemistry could erupt between us here.
Chemistry is definitely a major theme of Prometheus too.
Oh, yeah.
So, as I ask all my guests, what is your history with Alien and specifically Prometheus?
Oh, well, Alien's one of those movies that I saw, like, way, way too young, pretty much. It was just because it was a famous, brand name film. Like, I think I couldn't remember what age I was when I saw it, but I was definitely younger than 10. And it was just one of those things. It's just like, I think maybe because it was so big that my parents were just like, oh, yeah, it must be harmless. Like, it's fine. Like, it's not The Exorcist, so go ahead and watch it.
Yeah.
Always loved it. So much so, like, throughout my entire life that by the time Prometheus was coming, like, I was, like, so jazzed for this film. I remember the Quiet Eye promo with Noomi Rapace.
Oh, yeah.
And been, like, watching that and been like, this is going to be the greatest thing ever. Because that little, viral video thing is so creepy. And it was so intriguing at the time. So then when actually, I was out of this... I think it wasn't even opening night. I think it was a preview night. I remember walking down to the Odeon box office, like the big chain of cinemas in the UK is the Odeon, and they had. I just remember the guy drastically trying to upsell me the tickets. Like I was like, cause I was getting a bunch for like a load of people, and I was just like, yep, well, four tickets for Prometheus, please, on this the preview date. And the guy's just like, you want that in like IMAX? And I was like, no. He's like, you want it in 3D? And I was like, no. And he's just like, you need this in the IMAX 3D, don't you? And I was like, well, no, I'm fine.
I wish I could have seen it in IMAX.
But I was just like, really like, no, I just want the standard thing. And he's just like, trust me, you want this in IMAX. You want it in 3D. You want this. And I was like, have you seen this or something? He's like, no, I haven't seen it. But I'm telling you, you're going to want to watch it. And it's like, well, how do you know? No, I just want it in standard definition, and I want it on a normal size screen. But I mean, like the IMAX we have in Liverpool is just looks like a slightly bigger screen. And there's one in Manchester, which apparently is the biggest in the country. And I went up to see Rogue One on that, and that to me was just like, yeah, it's just a bigger screen. I wasn't as invested in it as some like a lot of other people are. Like you get people like Chris Nolan who's just like barging forward with IMAX, just like, no, this is the way forward for cinema and stuff. But I don't get 3D either, because I went to see Avatar in 3D when it came out, and that's acclaimed as like the greatest 3D experience in a film pretty much ever. And like I think it's because I've got a lazy eye, so maybe I'm not got perfect 20/20 vision, because I was like taking off the glasses midway through going, is this in 3D? And then when you see the screen's blurred when you take the glasses off, it's like, I guess it is, but not once as a thing popped out of the screen to me. It just looks like a normal film.
Huh. Yeah, maybe it's like something to do with the synchronicity between eyes or something. And if it's just slightly off, it doesn't work.
It must be. Because I know I did tell a friend and she was like, maybe it's because you see everything in 3D already. And I was just like, everybody sees everything in 3D. And
you see in 4D.
I felt bad because she was genuinely trying to be like, be nice about it. And I was like, I'm going to have to be a dick and point out that the world is in 3D.
When you describe the marketing as being sort of creepy and intriguing, I think that's a really great way to describe it. There was just this... I was really fascinated about this project leading up to it because everything we saw just pulled you in and you just, oh, I want to know more about how... What is this? What is that about?
Yeah. I think that was... What's the kind of strange thing about it is that, like, And I'm sure you've got, like, you know, the people on there probably will be a mixed reaction. But I'm assuming you're a fan of the film if you're doing it minute by minute.
Very much so. I seem to like terrible movies. I don't know what that is. Or movies that a lot of people don't love. So Prometheus by Minute, my main inspiration was, this is such a divisive film, but I think there's actually a lot here that's worth defending and exploring. But also, there's a lot of goofy shit that I'm not afraid to make fun of as well. So, like, when Milburn and Fifield, I think those are some of my funniest episodes. I had a friend of mine, Clara, she was on for those episodes, and we had a great old time making fun of the scene where it's, oh, look, it's she's beautiful, oh, and then he gets mauled by it.
Because the thing was, we went to see it, and it was, like, me, my friend Willow, who's, like, a big sci-fi guy. Like, he's just really, like, he's one of those people, like, you would never assume he's into sci-fi. It seems like, you know, quote-unquote, a normal person, like, a non-nerdy kind of person. But he's, like...
But was he named after the movie Willow?
Because his name is Michael Wilson, but in Liverpool, nickname is going to be whatever O, basically. That's what they're going to call you, He became Willow. But
I wonder if Australians copied that from our British ancestors. Could we go Davo?
That could be. It was a specific group of Scouse people sent over to Australia. And they're like, we're taking over this country, damn it.
Yeah, probably.
Sorry, we're taking over this country, yeah. would be a more accurate rendition. But the thing is, like, yeah, Willow was like, me and him afterwards were like, ooh, I wasn't too sure about that. But we went with two other people who weren't all that invested. They were just like, oh, yeah, we'll just go to see it just because. They loved it. They were really like, that was great. So I was like, no, because I thought, I know they told you it wasn't going to be an alien movie, but I kind of was hoping it was going to be more of an alien movie. And then I read
that will come up in our minutes a little bit, is they sort of get up to the line of, ooh, is this going to be an alien moment? Yeah. It isn't.
But the thing is, afterwards, John
Spates, yeah.
The script for the, you know, alien engineers got online. I was like, I'm reading this. And then after that, I was like, oh yeah, I would have preferred that. When it's just like, it's Prometheus, but it's just an alien movie as well. Not like just an alien movie, but it's this movie with the alien stuff you want in it. And I was like, why didn't they make this? I would infinitely have preferred this. And then the ironic thing was I didn't mind Alien Covenant as much as a lot of people, mostly because I just really love both Michael Fassbender and Catherine Waterston. And I was like, oh, they're in a film together, great.
Yes.
But the thing is, as much as I love her, all the stuff with the Covenant crew, I was like, don't care about this. Give me more David. I want to see, this should be a movie of him and Sean.
Yeah.
And yet it's not. It's like the little bits of him.
I like Daniels and Walter. I think they've got great chemistry. They were a very intriguing relationship. So might have to have you back on for Alien Covenant to discuss that.
Well, the thing is, even at the end of Alien Covenant, and I was like, yeah, it's very flawed as well. And at the same time, I was like, I love Catherine Waterston. I do like Daniels as a character, but like, I wanted more of... I could have foregone her had it just been a Shaw-David movie. But at the end of Covenant, I was just like, oh no, I want to see what happens next now. Because I know they were going... like, people were saying, like, because of the recurring religious stories that got going on, the next one will be like, well, Daniels... it'll be Daniel in the lines then. That's what the next story is going to be. And it's like... I want to see that. But now it's kind of like, hey, maybe, you might, potentially, you never know. You know?
I'm very anxious about knowing where this, well, if it's going to be a trilogy or they're going to finish it up as a TV series. I'm fine with whatever, just give me more, please.
I think even now, because just the other month I finished the Amazon production of William Gibson's Alien 3 script.
Yeah.
So I was like, ooh, because it got in Lance Henriksen and Michael Bane and stuff. And like, you actually listen to it, it's a bit like, yeah, I actually quite like Alien 3. So I'm just like, yeah, I'm fine with what we got. But I can imagine, because they're still releasing things like that, even if a sequel to Covenant never happens, 10 years down the line, you'll probably get like, well, here was the idea. And then someone's adapted that into a script, and then that's an audio drama or a comic book or something. It'll be out there in some form down the years, but maybe not as a big budget movie, you know?
Yeah, and I feel Fassbender's really invested. Ridley's definitely invested. So if it falls through, then I feel pretty confident that we're going to see some conclusion to this story in one form or another.
That's the weird thing, is that all the crap the two movies get, it's kind of like, you can't really knock the visual direction, and you really can't knock Michael Fassbender. So it's like, yeah, these two guys, they're the best parts of it, really. Like, you can argue Ridley Scott's messing up his own mythology and whatnot, but...
I almost don't care. It's just, oh, this looks so cool, and the music's so cool, and the performances are just, yes.
Well, it's kind of at this point, because it's kind of like too late. You're like, oh, Ridley Scott keeps messing up the alien mythology. He's like, well, he's already done it. You might as well just let him keep doing it.
Yeah, sort of how I learned to stop worrying and embrace Ridley Scott's new direction. I think that the best thing about Prometheus and Alien Covenant is that you can go up to anybody and go, you know, it wasn't the best movie ever. No, it was the worst movie ever. It's just, there's no middle ground with the prequels. And another movie that's a bit like that was, and they came out around the same time, was The Dark Knight Rises.
Oh, yeah.
People were so conflicted over that. But that's good, because you end up having that's the best car ride home from a cinema, is when you're all in the car and everyone just, they can't stop talking about the movie and going, well, what did you think of this and what of that? And you just have, you generate so many ideas. Whereas I remember coming home from The Avengers and it was just like, oh, yeah, that was really good. That was it.
I do, like, the thing is, like, Dark Knight Rises is a weird one, because I think it's getting progressively more hated as the years go by. Like, people are letting...
I actually love it more as time goes on, because I didn't like it initially, and I watched it recently, and I was like, this is a really good version of Bane.
Oh, that's the thing, because, like, I know, like, my co-host on Batman, John, hates Dark Knight Rises. He always did. Like, we went to see it together, and he walked out, and he's like, what the hell was that? Like, he was really outraged. But my only beef with it was just, like, well... Because Batman Begins in particular, and even The Dark Knight, their whole thing is that they're setting up to... This is the lead-in to the expanded Batman universe. So at the end of Batman Begins, you're like, this is the beginning of his whole journey. So you're going to see all those crazy villains like Clayface and Killer Croc and stuff. They'll be in the mythos here somewhere, but this is the beginning of the tale. And then even at the end of The Dark Knight, the Joker is just like, well, you and I are destined to do this forever. Because they're saying that literally because the Joker and Batman is a continuing thing that's gone throughout 70-odd years of comics now.
I like that they never... Conclusive?
Yeah, that's the thing. Yeah, it just seemed that this one then is like, they're just going, okay, this is the end. It was three movies. And there is no Batman after this. Yeah. And it's like, oh. Once you accept that, you go like, well, this isn't the end of Batman in the world. Of course, you're going to be like, you can go out and read Batman freaking anywhere you want at any given time. It's Chris Nolan going, like, I know that's what I was seeming like I was doing, but it was actually only ever going to be three movies, apparently. And it's just, yeah, this is the definitive end. I was like, okay, I can accept that. And if you just get around little things like, why is he moping for, like, eight friggin' years and he doesn't even bother fixing his leg and stuff? It's like, the thing, like, after, like, year three, you'd be like, maybe I should start doing something, you know? It's a bit like...
No, it's too depressed, can't be bothered, can't even shave, it's just too much effort. Yeah, I appreciate that he went for this sort of definitive trilogy without, I think a lot of superhero movies, especially these days, it's just, oh, and here's set up for the next one, and the next one, and the next one. It's just, oh, it was nice to have an ending.
I'm still, the thing is, as well, because I love Bane in it, and I love the silly voice.
Yes.
I can admit that it's silly, but I also genuinely love it. And just even trying to come up with, like, why does he talk like that? Why does he, has he got, like... whatever disease was in the pit, maybe that, like, messed up his face and he's had to learn how to talk again, but...
Yeah, I think they, like, when Talia escaped, everyone jumped on him and they tore at his face, so it might actually be, you know, he's missing part of his face.
Yeah, yeah. And it's, like, I do remember, like I had a friend who was very invested in the films, and he was just like, well, what's the thing about Talia al Ghul? You don't know anything about it. Why should we care at the end? And I was like, you know everything about Talia al Ghul, because everything you were taught about Bane... is just her. You don't know who Bane is, but you know everything about Talia al Ghul and stuff.
Yeah.
Which is why then at the end it's kind of a disservice that the fact that her death is terrible as well. It's like...
Oh, both of them go out like complete suckers. It's just, oh, in the last minute, I guess we should get rid of these characters. So you get stabbed and you get hit by a bat cycle.
I think I actually quite like Bane's death, though, because it was just so out of nowhere and so unexpected. It was like, what the Jesus Christ, where did that come from?
But that's how he gets... That's how he gets taken out in every fucking iteration. Like in the Arkham games, what is it? A big old vehicle. And what is it in Gotham? It's a car. He has to get hit by a car. Not that I watch Gotham. Yeah, no, I'm kind of into it. It's terrible.
I think we were considering, like, we're starting up Patreon content now. We're like, maybe we should finally watch Gotham. Because I tried for like 3 episodes. And I was like, this is just not landing.
Okay, you know how you do it? My friends and I, we had a movie night where we just watched the season finales out of context. We didn't even watch the previously on Gotham. It was the best night of our lives. Holy shit.
Actually, that sounds like a pretty good idea. So yeah, I might well actually end up doing it.
Yeah. Because from there I went, oh, I'm actually really invested in this stupid soap opera. Give me more, please.
I've seen like little bits of it because I would chip in. When, like, I can see, like, oh, they are doing the Joker now. They won't admit they're doing it, but that's blatantly who this guy is. So I'd come in the odd episode.
Jerome.
Yeah, and I'd come in and be like, okay, I don't like what you're doing, but I see it. I see what you're doing here. But I'd come in, like, again, out of context, and I watched a bit of the finale episode, like, the very last episode, because I wanted to see, like, oh, they've
got... That's a weird one to come in on.
But it was just then seeing, like, the fully-fledged versions of the Penguin and the Riddler, and it's like... These guys are clearly in, like, the 1960s show, whereas everyone else is in, like, a different freaking program. Because they're so campy and over the top, and they're just like, they don't even look like they're comfortable in the costumes. They just look like we've rented out these Halloween costumes, and now we're playing the Penguin and the Riddler and stuff. It's like, you were at this for how many years, and you still don't look like you've settled into your outfits yet?
I think, well, especially with the Penguin, the problem is they kind of wanted to put him in a fat suit, but not really. So you're like, is that just not fitting properly, or what is... Oh, okay. No, go full on friggin' Danny DeVito, my friend. Don't hold back.
As well, but well, so you can defend it in Batman Returns, though, because we've looked at it, like, obviously, minute by minute now, and there are some shots where, like, you can really tell, like, oh, that's just a suit he's got on.
Yeah.
Like, you can see the folds and stuff. But at the same time, because he's supposed to be this really mutated, you know, freak and stuff, you can be like, well, maybe his body just weird, like, his body's just, like, covered with, like, a friggin' nest of... kind of almost benign tumors or something. Yeah. Just like that's why it looks so strange and like it's folding in and stuff. If you want to just look pave over the cracks or things like that, it's perfectly doable. Whereas in that episode of Gotham, I was like, this looks weird. It doesn't look right at all.
Yeah, it's always the way when you've got more monstrous or deformed characters, it's like everything is acceptable. There's no rules. It's wonderful. But bringing it all back around, with the... I knew I was going to go on a Batman tangent. I couldn't help myself.
No, I'm always happy to talk about Batman.
Hell yeah. But the monsters in the Alien franchise tend to be quite beautiful. There's always got to be this sort of symmetry and very... It's very mechanical. It's very precise, which is quite fascinating to me. And not you don't see a lot of that in other stories. It's usually, you know, yes, big, grotesque, mutated... creatures.
I always remember, and like specifically like years ago, reading, I think it was in like Empire magazine or something, they had like a feature about like the design of aliens and stuff in cinema, and I remember they got in some expert, and he was just like, yeah, he thought the alien was like one of the not the worst design, but he was just like, I don't get what this is though, because you look at that, he's just like, what would make that? What environment would create a creature this harsh? Like, what? How could this thing have ever come into being? Like, he was very limited. It's like, well, it's a sci-fi thing. It's supposed to be even beyond your comprehension. But I also wondered
if... Well, I guess he's kind of right in hindsight. It's like, well, it was created by an android, an insane android.
I thought that's the thing. I do wonder, because, you know, Ridley Scott's a UK guy, and he's been interviewed in Empire loads of times. It wouldn't surprise me if he read that. And he's just like, you know what? You're right. I've never explained what would have created this exact organism and stuff. And it's like, well, and I wonder what... I guess it would have to have been created by a machine itself and stuff like that. Maybe it was designed to be a weapon. And it wasn't just a naturally occurring thing. It was a weaponized creature and stuff like that. So I've always wondered, like, yeah, when Ridley Scott, he was just like that stuck in his craw way years ago.
Right, I'm going to make these huge budget movies just to correct this one dude in an Empire interview from 40 years ago.
And then finally, like, does that guy ever got back to it? And he's just like, I've never watched Prometheus. He's like, oh, God damn it, dude.
So, in this minute, David opens another door, revealing a hallway lined with four engineer exoskeletal spacesuits. I feel this is the first time we get a proper sense of their scale in relation to humans and human-adjacent beings.
Mm. That opening shot, though, not the, you know, it'll sound like I'm, you know, poo-pooing the visual style of the movie, but that looks very video gamey to me. This because of that, because we're...
it's very hard to do that first person shooter sort of angle and not make it look like you're making Doom.
That's the thing though, because I also played Alien Isolation like a couple years back.
Oh, very good.
The thing is, a great game. Loved it and hated it in succession because it's so difficult. And I remember actually I gave it to one of my friends and I was just like, take this game, it's great, but get it the hell out of my house because I never want to see it again. But that I was just getting a little, because that's the same kind of visual stuff. I was just like, oh my God, a flash of it. Oh my God, I'm back in isolation. I'm trapped in that game again. Damn it.
Getting a bit of PTSD.
Yeah, just like, oh, I spent like 2 weeks of my life playing that thing. Never again.
It's so intense as an experience. It's not that it wasn't particularly hard for me. I'm quite good at video games usually, but it was just, oh, if I breathe in real life too loud, it will hear me.
I think that you should talk to John about it, actually, because he's like, video games are his thing. Like, he's a big, big video game guy. And he was the one saying to me, like, oh, it's too difficult for me. Like, that was him saying it about himself. He's like, oh, I can't finish this thing. It's impossible. Wow. And then I was shocked when I was playing it. I was like, it is pretty hard at the beginning. But once you get used to the mechanics... Once you get used to the fact that, like, oh, these androids will even freaking kill you.
The androids are fun.
Once you got used to that, like, I remember, I have another friend of mine, Jack Harvey, who's been on Batminute. And he was like, oh, he had to stop halfway through. He's like, it's too scary. It's too tense. I can't. And he was complaining about, like, the level you have to go into the decks the alien has taken over. And I remember I did that in one go. But I remember it being the most tense bit of the game because you are just like, something's going to happen any goddamn second. And you're really just like... going as slowly as you can, and everything's just like every single inch of the screen you're examining all the time to see where it's going to come from and stuff. But I remember, like, I got through that in one go and I was like, that was the best part. It was so tense. And he's like, I had to give up. I decided to walk away from it. It was killing me to play that thing.
It's a game of mental discipline. The difficulty, well, at least in my opinion, it does not come from the actual mechanics of the game. It is just about knowing when to not to wait and when to move and just keeping your heart rate steady.
It is a lot of stuff of, like, you know, you're gonna have to just be patient. Like, a lot of you're thinking, like, you could make a break for it now, but you will die if you just think, oh no, I can go for it now. It's like, no, if you're not 100% certain that you can move, you won't be able to move. Like, it will come out of something and it will get you. But it is a great game, but it's also just like it's way too. It's too much as well. It's just like it's such an exhausting experience at the end.
It did its job too well.
Although at the same time, if they, much like, you know, walking out of Alien Covenant, been like, oh, that wasn't the best, but like I didn't mind it. But like, hey, if they make a sequel, I'll be first in line. If they make another Alien Isolation, it's like, all right, well, sign me up. I guess I'm going back in.
Alien Covenant blew my goddamn mind, because I had sort of forgotten about Prometheus, and then I watched that and just went, holy shit, this has gone in a totally different direction, I get it now. Because I think Prometheus, on its own, I think it's a standalone film, but when you put it with Covenant, it takes on a whole new meaning, and I was suddenly very invested in a story about androids that I've always wanted.
Mm. Well, that's the thing, like, I was just so... I think it's Covenant, it's just like, it's a film that's just like... I guess we better make it more like an alien movie. But then this is like, well, the best part of Prometheus, though, like, you ended on a good note of like, well, let's go out the adventure of these two characters. You got rid of all the, you know, the cannon fodder and stuff, and like, now you're down to your core people, you care about. Not that I didn't care about Fifield and all those guys, but I just mean, like, at the end of it, you're just like, I would have taken, I'm sure maybe they were just like, no one would ever friggin' pony up the money for it. But if the Alien Covenant began with like half hour of just Shaw and David in the ship together talking.
Yeah.
And just getting closer to the planet and stuff. That, and then just seeing their relationship change and seeing what David does instead of getting little snippets of it in flashback. That would have been amazing.
It could have, or do it as sort of a post-mortem. So you are following the story of the Covenant crew as we already do in that script. But then when there's the flashback, maybe actually just spend like half an hour showing everything that led up to those events. And in a very early script, I think, for The Crossing, which was one of the viral videos that they released before it, that was going to have basically everything, you know, from the moment they take off from LV-223 to their journey to the engineer homeworld. But yeah, they just ended up cutting all of that out.
Yeah, it's so bizarre, though, because it's just like, and this movie, you know, your protagonist is Shaw, and she gets the end line. So you're like, if you're coming back for another one, it's like, I want to see her. And then it's the fact that she's just like, yeah, you see a body, and that's it. Like, you don't get seeing her. And it's like, but I like her. I want to see more of her. And it feels so bad now because you see her go through absolute hell in this movie, having to friggin' give herself a cesarean and then staple her own stomach and stuff. And then at the end, to find out, like, yeah, but I guess maybe it's a endemic of the Alien franchise as a whole. It's like, I remember what, you know, Newt and Hicks had to go through in Aliens. And then the next time you see them, they're already dead. It's like, oh, for God's sake.
Exactly. Yeah, I was about to say the same thing. Alien is, it ties into that theme of it's existential. It's about how indifferent the universe is. It doesn't matter how charming or likable you are. The universe don't give a shit.
Or it's just Ridley Scott. This is him playing God. He's just like, you know what? I made you. I can break you just as easily. And Noomi Rapace is like, what the hell did I do to you? He's like, get out of here, Noomi. I just need your face for a body cast. That's all I need you for in this next movie.
That must have been a weird experience where it's like, you're kind of back for this movie, but not really. We're just going to take some molds. Yep. And we're just going to make lots of drawings of you that are quite disturbing.
Yeah. It's just like, it's, you know, Ridley, I am free. Like, yeah, I know. Just, okay, so I'll see myself out here. Like, yeah, I'll see you. Just like, this him sitting talking to Catherine Waterston. He's just like, oh, so this is the new girl, huh?
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, new favorite.
And it's the Covenant sequel gets going. Just Catherine Waterston showing up the set and seeing some other, like, Kristen Ritter or someone's there. And she's like, who's this? Who's this chick? What she's doing here? Like, oh, Catherine, you just go over to this little small office over here, okay? And we'll talk to you about getting those body casts done. Body cast. Oh no!
I wonder if there was discussion about, you know, trying to make Noomi Rapace the next Sigourney Weaver, and making this a series where she is the final girl, the recurring protagonist.
I'm sure there must have been. Like, I'd hope there was, because then you become so invested in this, and if she's not dead at the end, you do want to see more, but.
I think she's an interesting character. She goes on an interesting journey. There's some clunky stuff in the dialogue and how her faith is written clearly by an atheist who has never had a history with Catholicism or Christianity. But if we can look past that, I think Noomi herself brings a lot to that performance, and there's a lot to Shaw, and I think she counters David quite well. Mm. And that's what we're kind of missing in Covenant, is that he's basically the Freddy Krueger or the Jason Voorhees of Alien Covenant. And yeah, he doesn't really have anyone to play off of other than Walter, sort of.
Mm.
Walter doesn't even have opinions.
Oh, well, this is like, they find out like on set, like, it's very hard to get someone who can keep up with Michael Fassbender. Let's just have him keep up with himself. Like, there you go. Just two of them.
Yeah, that was a brilliant idea. I do think about that. Elijah Wood was at Supernova comic convention we have here recently. Someone asked, have you ever been intimidated by someone you were working alongside? And he went, Nicolas Cage, without even missing a beat. Just, holy shit, you just unleash that man. You watch him go and you don't know what to do with yourself.
That's understandable.
Oh yeah, I feel like Fassbender would be about the same, where it's just, oh God, I gotta try and keep up with you.
He's such a, like, a... He's a completely fearless performer too, because it's like, I've seen you watch something like Shame,
yes,
and it's like, I've seen more of Michael Fassbender's body than I have my own.
Yeah, basically.
Like, this guy, he's so open for just like, I'll do anything on screen. I will literally go whatever you need me to do. I'm comfortable.
Yeah. Have you seen what was the movie where he has the paper mache mask on the whole time?
Oh, Frank.
Frank.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've actually seen the real life, Frank Sidebottom in real life a couple of years back.
Wow.
I was like, so when I was going into that, like, I was like, is this an actual Frank Sidebottom wasn't American. What the hell's going on here? And then you watch the film, it's like, it's not a biopic of Frank Sidebottom. There is now, there's a documentary about him.
It's sort of inspired by, loosely.
I think it's the day that they just took the head. They're like, we like that head.
Basically, so we're gonna... yeah.
But it was still a great film, and it was just more like, oh, this just wasn't what I was expecting. But yeah, again, he was phenomenal in that. Just the fact Michael Fassbender gave me a performance for like 98% of a film behind a papier-mâché head that has no expression on it, and he still completely invests you in that character and stuff.
He's so cool. Okay, so back to the minute. The hall leads to an iconic alien set, the bridge of the ship, looking very much like that of the derelict.
Mm.
Now, it's hard to tell where the ship begins, because we know this is definitely the console room, and that out of that floor in the middle there will be the big sort of telescope thing, but like, where does the ship begin? Well, where does the hallway end, the temple end, and the ship begin? I'm not sure.
Yeah. I was confused as well, because he walks through, there's four engineers standing, like, Beefeaters, and I was like, are these fossilized remains of engineers who died standing up? Like, they were real, like, we're going down with the ship, but they just died somehow standing in perfect formation? Or are these statues that they've made? Or are these just the suits, like, they're on mannequins? It's just hard to because you've seen so many fossilized remains already, you're like, you're inclined to think they must be fossils. But then it doesn't make much sense as to why they're just standing staring at each other to death for whatever reason.
Yeah, well, we know, well, in the room itself, you see that there are these cryo chambers that do have deceased engineers in it. So, yeah, they're probably just spare suits. But again, and that's going back to Giger's particular design aesthetic and the way he conceptualized the space jockey as... It just looks dead. There's the aesthetic of death through this whole temple.
What do you think actually of the finished engineer design, the big white guy? Because that was always the thing that slightly irked me, because you're so used to the space jockey, and it's like, oh, this weird creature with a kind of elephant face and stuff. Yeah. And then to discover, like, nah, that ain't it. It actually just looks like a big white guy.
I've gone back and forth on it, because I do remember my absolute favorite part of the original Alien was the space jockey. I just thought, what is that? Why didn't they ever explain more about it? Oh, yes, they've sort of done it in the comics, but that doesn't count.
Yeah.
And when they did finally reveal them to be white humanoids in Prometheus, I was sort of taken aback at first. I don't really know... Oh, I probably would have been the moment where they took the decapitated one. They took the helmet off. It's probably when it sunk in. They went, oh, right, they're both the same creature.
Mm.
At first, I was a little disappointed. But now my podcast is almost my thesis. It's a very, very long essay. And I've discovered that thematically, making them kind of humanoid makes way more sense. It evokes so many more concepts philosophically and theologically and all of that. So I get it. And I think there's something a bit... It's Uncanny Valley, that they're so close to human, but they're just not quite, especially when you see them standing next to a human.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's one of those things, like, I can understand, like, now, like, I guess, because, you know, God made man in his own image, so therefore it should make sense that the gods that created humanity within this should look a bit more like, you know, mankind, basically.
Yeah, otherwise, if they were elephantine, then you're like, wait, are elephants secretly the most superior species on Earth? What?
That'd be great, just the actual end of the movie, it just cuts to, like, somewhere in Africa, and it's just, like, an elephant with his eyes shifting from side to side, like, planning something.
The shifty-eyed dog in The Simpsons.
And it's just, like, yeah, eventually, like, the end of, you know, Alien Covenant was actually Daniels making it back to Earth and then finding out that the world has been taken over by elephants. Like, what the hell?
You blew it all up.
Ridley Scott's just like, come back for the next one. Maybe in 6 years, maybe in 10, who knows when it's going to come out.
The final, well, towards the end, where the engineer snaps David's neck and he attacks all the humans. It's like, oh, because he was expecting elephants. I see.
It's like, oh, we messed this up, damn it.
Speaking, I don't want to tangent too much, but... I can't remember the name for people who study apes. There's primatologists. They are saying that chimpanzees and some other primates are entering their stone age.
Ooh.
And boy, that's scary. Well, we got competition.
It's like, hey, a couple of million years time, you better watch your back, humanity.
We're coming for you.
Meanwhile, while they're concentrated on the apes, the elephants are just out there just like, you guys don't know what's coming. It's like, you think you got us, our backs to the wall. That's what we're allowing you to think.
Yeah, if only humans lived long enough that we could take bets. Like, are we going to be overthrown by elephants? Is it going to be chimpanzees? Is it going to be octopuses? My money's on the octopuses.
You think it's time for them to rise up?
It's just a matter of time. It's a matter of time, you know? They'll figure out how to make land suits instead of, you know, scuba suits. I don't know what you call a land suit, but yes, they'll figure it out.
This could be, like, one of those things that they ever do come up with, like, proper cryogenically freezing, just signing up for. It's like, I want you to wake me every couple of, like, 1,000 years just so I can see who's winning.
Yes. That is probably the kind of bet that Wayland would have. I bet he's definitely... I bet. He's got very, very long-term plans. Mm.
I just imagine like him getting up to the engineer like, tell me what the elephants have planned. And they're like, oh, he figured it out. Ripping off David's head. You're not supposed to know, Wayland.
When David enters the chamber, this is a precise moment that he decides to cut off the feed to Vickers. Interestingly, there's a pulsing sound when the camera is switched off, and I'll add a sample of that here.
You son of a bitch. Cut me off.
It's not clear if it's diegetic or non-diegetic, and it feels like it's probably just there to add, a heightened sense of impact to that action in addition to the music.
Because this is pretty much like one of the only lines of dialogue in the whole minute. But it's so unnecessary. In fact, she goes like, oh, son of a bitch, you cut me off. It's like, thanks, Ben Vickers. Like, we couldn't figure out what was happening there. Like, even just son of a bitch would have been fine. But then I'm going to go, just for the people in the back row, he turned off the camera.
Yeah, I mean, she delivers it very well. I do love her line reading on it. But, it's not really necessary. And, in fact, in the last minute, I was just praising this movie for a less is more approach where there was no dialogue between the two of them because it wasn't necessary. I mean, a bit of a, fuck, I think. People exclaim like that to themselves, but, yeah, it does seem unnatural.
Her delivery is good as well. It's just that it's, because you could have gone another way, but she could have been like thumping the table and been like, "Oh, son of a bitch!" You know, like, but she almost has a kind of quiet admiration for it. I'm just like, "You son of a bitch!" Like, because they're already.
It's like, you magnificent bastard! I read your book.
Exactly. Yeah, it's just got this real like, it's well played, David. You
know? Yeah, I mean, she's already. I was thinking about that she's not going to be surprised and not going to be outraged, because it's just, this is a confirmation of what she already suspected, and that, you know, she's not in as much control as she thought she was. And I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that David and Wayland do this to her all the time.
Oh, no, I would not be surprised if that was just literally the environment she grew up in, was just...
Oh, Meredith, did I not tell you that the board meeting was an hour earlier? Oh, sorry. Don't know how that slipped my mind.
Just even like, oh, David, could you pass the potatoes? Just, no. Like, son of a bitch. And this Wayland at the head of the table just snickering away to himself.
I've talked about this before. I really want more of the Wayland family. I think that would be doing a prequel show of the Wayland family. Yes, please.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But again, that was a thing. I don't want to encroach on other people's minutes because that'll be coming up. But that was a thing that struck me as like, was this supposed to be something more? When like she refers to him as father. It's like, he was her dad the whole time.
Yeah.
And it's like, so? Like, why couldn't you have just told us that from the get-go? Like, why did it have to be a secret?
That's something I've been thinking about a lot, too. And yeah, I don't think anyone has those particular minutes yet. But I have been wondering, well, how am I going to approach this? And it's one of those reveals, like the Benedict Cumberbatch, my name is Khan. oh, was, am I supposed to gasp now? Like, what does that mean?
Yeah. That was such a drastic misstep of this, like, don't tell anybody that he's Khan. But then, like, everybody who was into Star Trek already knew because they had well, for one, they had already told you Benicio Del Toro was going to be playing Khan, and then he dropped out, and then the Cumberbatch came in. But then it's just more like, if you don't know who Khan is, that means nothing to you?
Yeah.
And if you do know who he is, you're like, I know this already, because I've been invested enough in, like, if you're in the Star Trek that deep, you'll have known, like, way in the early stages that they were planning to bring that character in.
I went to a, it was part of Comic-Con, but it was just like a Benedict Cumberbatch weekend, so we did a panel and signings and photos and stuff, and I was dressed as Khan, and I got off and asked him a question, but we sort of did a bit of back and forth dialogue, so I was like, I'm better at what? Everything? Yeah, pretty much.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that was fun. I'm so glad that I'm very fearless when it comes to meeting celebrities. I know so many people who just like, oh, I've had to pee 3 times already and I don't know if I can talk. And
I do know, we recorded a hiatus episode of Batminute just the other day with our friend Stephanie. And she just mentioned somehow Kristen Shaw came up in conversation, and because Stephanie lives in LA now. She's like, she was at a party I was at just the other week. And I was like, I was going to go up to her, but I was just like, no, I wouldn't know what to say to her and stuff. And I was kind of like, yeah, same. Like, I would want to be open, like, oh my God, it's Kristen Shaw, I love you. But, like, I don't know anything she said back to me. I'd be like, I don't know how to respond to you, because I just admire you as a performer, but I don't know how to engage with you in conversation at all.
Yeah, because you've got very limited time, so everything has to count. You've got to be so focused and in the moment, and most people can't do that. It's just like, oh, I'm going to love you.
I think I went to a book signing once by Henry Winkler.
Oh, yeah.
So at the end, it's like, I don't know if it was... I could have been like, oh, he was a dick or whatever, but it was just more like, when I got up there, you know, he just signed the book. I just shook his hands like, thank you. And he just kind of looked at me like, uh-huh. Okay. Like, you want to say something else? And I was just like, see ya.
Because in your experience, like, this is the biggest moment of my life. And then they're just like, oh, yes, another person. Hello.
Yeah. It's like, you were literally like the 100th person I've said hello to today. Like, it's...
Yeah. Going back to this set, this is the first time we've seen it in 30-odd years or so. And I wonder what that's like, especially for Ridley Scott, to see it rebuilt in this perfect replica of such an iconic set.
Yeah, it must be. Particularly, too, it was like he had a bad experiences making Alien. So I was like, oh, I never want to see this place again. And then now he's willingly bringing it upon himself. Like, oh, look, you know, look where it brought him back to me.
I think it's a real shame that, you know, we're able to preserve costumes, props, scripts, almost everything associated with film. But what gets dismantled first? The sets. No one ever bought, or very rarely do people buy them up and keep them on display. Because I've asked a few friends this. We would all pay good money to go to some kind of museum or theme park where, oh, here's all the sets to Prometheus and Alien, and oh, here's all the sets to Star Wars, the prequels. So it's all just green screens. You'll have to take our word for it. It's the exact same green screen.
I was imagining like a situation like that episode of Seinfeld where Kramer steals the Merv Griffith set, and just people coming into Connor's house. It's like, yeah, he's got the engineer ship just in his living room.
Yeah.
people walking into like a dinner party of yours, and it's just like David entering this giant cavern, like, holy crap, Connor, you've got a big place here. Like, yeah, well, the kitchen's actually ironically very small, but it's in the back.
Yeah. Is there even a kitchen in the temple? Because, like, people are living here, you know? They've got to eat food, right? You got to cook, maybe? I don't know. Or is it just all that weird jelly ball stuff from the beginning of the movie?
I think, though, because those engineers are ripped. Mm. Like, they look like that's a high-protein diet they're on. Like, and they're... Unless it's just one of those ones that are like, oh, we're just naturally this way. I'm like, oh, quit showing off, engineers. God damn it, with your friggin' six packs and your 20 packs that you've got there and your huge rippling bodies.
Oh, you know what? They've definitely been, well, not even juicing. It's just genetic augmentation. So, you know, a little less myostatin here, a little more this, that, and the other. Myostatin's the only thing I know.
I was imagining, though, like, when the engineers are actually born, they're just like that kind of weird octopusy blob thing that Shaw gives birth to. And it's like, oh yeah, then they get in the gym and they get on the steroids. And at the end, you got your engineer.
That reminds me of, have you seen the movie Splice?
Oh, yeah.
Yes, you start off as like a little weird mousy thing, and then you sort of become human-ish.
That's such a strange film. That was just one of the ones that's like, this guy's, we've created life. I wonder if I could shag it. Like, it's the first go-to thought.
It's technically my daughter, but...
It's like, you know, she looks like she's coming on to me, though. So I was like, dude, what the hell are you doing?
Very different interpretation of Frankenstein.
I think the guy who made that was Vincenzo Natali, I think.
Vincenzo Natali,
yeah. He was a guest on The Shining 237. Because I remember it just been like...
Really?
We had Susan on that minute, and then she was just like... A couple of months later, she's like, oh, so this is Vincenzo. And then I was just like, he did the friggin' Hannibal. Like, this is a huge guest to get. But she was just so kind of like, he just likes The Shining, so he came on. I was like, oh, what, does he like Batman? Does he want to come on our show?
does he like Prometheus?
I think Prometheus would probably be more up his alley. So, like, drop him a line, see what happens.
Yeah, going back to the Weyland family and that whole dynamic, it reminds me of a lot of older films where there's just hints through dialogue or whatever that hint at a bigger world and more of a history, and it's never expanded upon because for a long time Hollywood didn't want to do sequels.
Yeah.
And nowadays, whenever there is a scene like that or a bit of dialogue or whatever that seems to imply something more, you go, ah, yep, I see what they're doing. Setting up for it's the Marvel syndrome.
Oh, yeah.
Another thing I really love about Prometheus visually, or the prequels visually, is how they work with light and shadow. I know you see this in the original Alien as well, that it's everything is quite clear. Whereas I find a lot of movies, especially, I don't know what it was, about the mid to late 2000s, you just couldn't see anything. It was just so dark. Like, if you watch the first AVP movie? No, both of them. It's pitch black. You can barely see anything. And I think, well, it might be a budgetary thing, but also just the technology of the time. I don't think people had quite worked out the kinks yet. But Prometheus looks great. It almost looks like Mike Mignola, you know, Hellboy, the artist for Hellboy.
Oh, yeah.
That kind of complete contrast between light and dark, or these bright pops of color and just black. And that's very hard to do on film, but they do it really well.
I mean, it's the thing the world has just come up against with, infamously, that episode of Game of Thrones where it's like, you couldn't see anything.
I was going to mention the same thing, and the cinematographer was like, no, I did it on purpose.
It's just like, you've not calibrated your TV properly, like, no. It's like, look at this film. It's 90% of it is complete darkness. You could make out everything. And it's like, I couldn't make out a goddamn thing in that episode.
It is crystal clear. The last few seconds of this minute, what are they called? Is it a phantom light or a non-diegetic light? I can't remember the word for it. But a light that doesn't seem to have a particular source. And yet, you can see every little line on the floor of the bridge of the ship. It's incredible.
Apparently, it was a quote from like the behind the scenes of Lord of the Rings or something. I think it was when Sean Astin might have been shooting like the Shelob scenes. And I think at one point he's going to Peter Jackson, like, where's this light coming from? Like, there's light here, but where's it coming from? And then Peter Jackson was like, it's coming from the same place the friggin' eagles are coming from, Sean. It's coming from the same place as the goddamn, the orcs and all that stuff. It's a fantasy, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, and that's something it always bothers me about film fans who just take it way too seriously, where it's like, well, this doesn't make sense, and this wouldn't be illogical, and how were they able to fast travel from here to... You know what? Shut the fuck up and let dreams come true. It's fantasy, and I bring up Chris Nolan a lot. Chris Nolan's a great example of, he just does whatever feels right. It's not about the logic. Even in something that can be quite technical, like Batman, it's just like, nah, Batman's going to drive into a what do you call it, like an underpass thing, and it's daytime on one end and nighttime on the other. Why? Because you don't want that Joker chase scene to be during daytime, because it's just not as dramatic. Duh.
Yeah, that's fair. Like, Nolan's a strange one, though, because he was the guy who was, like, stressing, like, it's more realistic. It's a more gritty, down-to-earth version of it. But at the same time, it was, like...
he almost beat himself in the ass with that.
But at the same time, he was always just a bit, like, he knew when to stop. He'd be like, all right, don't make it too realistic. You gotta have to have your silly, you know, it's gonna cover the city in fear gas kind of stuff, because that's the exciting stuff you want to get to. Whereas, like, if you were to go in reality, it's like, can you actually make a machine that'll vaporize an entire city's water supply within 2 seconds? Like, no, of course you couldn't do that. But
I mean, if you do a realistic Batman, it's about 20 minutes long and he dies the first time he tries to jump off a building, doesn't quite make it to the other side and breaks his back.
Again, Dark Knight Rises is like, this guy, like, shatters his a vertebrae in his back or something. I was like, how do you cure that? Oh, you get friggin' Tom Conti to punch you in the back and then hang off a rope for a week or something. And then it's like, oh, you'll be fine.
It's just willpower. You know, anyone with any sort of permanent injuries, illnesses, whatever, it's just you didn't have the willpower of Batman. That's clearly your problem. But I do like that... it's not that it's more realistic, it's just that it's more sophisticated. I think that's a better way of explaining what Nolan did. It's more like opera, is how I would explain it. That it's skewing towards an older audience, a bit more cultured. It's still Batman, but...
Oh, yeah.
It's big and theatrical in a way that, I don't know, Jim Carrey's Riddler could never be. It's very different.
There's some things, though, you can tell, like, if you look at the original script for The Dark Knight and you read some of the things as written, you can see how much, like, there must have been words with Heath Ledger, like, where he must have come up to them and been like, this character you've written is very dry. Like, they've written him to be a very grim version of the character, where he must have been like, you know, he is the Joker, though. Like, he's going to have to be, because there's a lot of little bits of dialogue that are funny in the movie that aren't in the script. And it's obviously him on set going...
Really?
Yeah, there's things like... you know, when he goes into the mob meeting and he's like, you think you can just, you know, steal from us and walk away? And then the movie, he's like, yeah. And I'd always get to laugh. That's not in the script. And like little things like, you know, like, you killed 6 of my friends. And he's like, oh, 6. And, you know, he does these things that are, you know, they get chuckles from the audience. And I think it must have been him going like, he's the Joker, though. He's got to be funny and he's got to be theatrical and he's got to be a little bit like he's taking joy in his work and stuff instead of this constantly smoldering and looking like he's just a sort of the sad clown all the time and stuff.
Oh, what a bloody legend.
Yeah.
He's a Perth boy too.
Oh, good. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it should be national pride for you right there as well.
Yeah. But yes, do you have any more notes for this minute?
Not for this minute in particular.
All right.
No, I think nothing that can't be brought up in the next, the following two, I don't know.
Yeah, we've gone long enough. Always happens with the first episode of a new guest. So, this is Coulson signing off. You can find me on travidesigns.com, TRAVIAN, or Prometheus by Minute on Facebook. And where can we find you now?
Oh, you can get me on Bat Minutes, where we're going through the Batman movies 1 minute at a time, through 89 through 97. We're not doing the Dark Knight trilogy because that's been covered by other people. But yeah, if you literally Google Bat Minute, we'll pop up. We're on Twitter, Facebook, we have the Bat Minute Listeners Cave. We have very active conversations on there about just the Batman and beyond in general. And yeah. It's literally the other day someone just posted up a random video of like Soviet synth pop because it was like, you guys will be into this. And we're like, yes I am. Just get us on any podcatcher, iTunes, we're all over the place. I think we're even on Spotify these days. So, yeah, if you look for us, we'll be out there.